From boardroom meetings to bedtime stories, Coffee in the Barn explores the delicate dance of balancing the demands of our professional lives with the joys and responsibilities of being moms. Join us each week as we discuss the latest trends in agribusiness, share insightful interviews with industry experts, and sprinkle in some heartfelt anecdotes about the humorous and heartwarming moments that come with being a working mom in agriculture. Welcome to this week's episode of Coffee in the Barn with Casey and Morgan. This week, we're going to be talking about the power of colostrum for human and animals, and we're very fortunate to have with us two guest speakers, Ellen DeFore with Hubbard Feeds and Bethany Dado with VitaPlus. Welcome, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time today out of your busy schedules to talk to us about something that you guys deal with on a daily basis.
I think before we start, Morgan, we could, you know, we're in the happy world of gals and not guys today. So this is a...
What did I say, guys?
Right.
Yeah, you said guys. I'm like, it's girls.
The girl power. You guys are both calf specialists. Can you both elaborate a little bit more on, like, what that means for your jobs, for the industry? Kind of what your day looks like. Bethany,
why don't you go
first?
Sure. Yeah, I can start. No problem.
Yeah. Whoever wants to go ahead.
Sure. I'll go first. So Ellen and I technically work for competitors. So, but we pretty much, I would guess, do very similar things. So kind of what it looks like for me is VitaPlus is a regional nutrition company to the Midwest. So my territory covers northern Wisconsin and all of Minnesota and pretty much wherever our staff needs us. My job is to support our staff and their customers, so dairy farmers, in raising a productive and healthy calf. So this can range from anything to developing standard protocols, to discussing things like colostrum and best practices, to, you know, building feeding curves. And honestly, the favorite part of my job is taking things from the troubleshooting and asking questions phases to developing solutions that best fit the farm's values and strategies to really get a high quality calf.
Yeah, like Bethany said, we do work for competitive companies, but I think it's pretty cool that we can kind of come together and talk about this ever recurring topic of colostrum, which seems to kind of be the bread and butter of a calf specialist for the most part. Similarly to Bethany, I work for a regional nutrition company also in the upper Midwest based out of Minneapolis. And I kind of cover most of Minnesota, northern Iowa, into South Dakota and Wisconsin. And again, it's mostly working with our sales team and our dealerships and a lot of time on farm. Again, troubleshooting issues that dairies might be having in terms of calf health and calf performance and really zoning in on what we can do to reduce any bottlenecks to get calves up to that next level so they can really perform well throughout their productive lifetime. So a very fun position to have. Lots of time on the road. I also get to collaborate with some research with the University of Minnesota, and I manage our calf and heifer product line with Hubbard Feeds as well. So lots of different hats, all calf related, and I love every second of it.
Oh, that's awesome. We all know that colostrum's important, but Ellen, maybe you can take this one. Why is colostrum so important for that baby calf, baby pig, baby livestock?
Yeah, good question. You know, I don't come from a dairy background or agricultural background at all. And when I learned the importance of colostrum in the livestock system, specifically in bovine, it was absolutely amazing. My jaw kind of hit the floor, and it was actually what really made me interested in working with calves. But like I said, colostrum is the bread and butter, you know, the building block to dairy calf health and performance. Essentially what happens in the pregnant cow is that cow is producing antibodies for herself, for her immune system. And there's no real way that baby calf can get that or get those antibodies while she's in utero. Due to the placenta of the cow, the thickness of that placenta, those big proteins don't really have any way of getting into that calf while she's in utero. So what happens is that cow then takes all those antibodies that she's been building, all that immunity, and she puts it into her colostrum, which is that first milking or those first few milkings of that cow. And once that calf is born, she either suckles the dam, she either gets bottle fed this colostrum from the first milking, and that's how that calf then gets all those antibodies, all that first immune function, immune system, that's really going to carry her through the first few weeks of life until that calf's own immune system can kind of catch up and develop on its own.
Do you have anything to add to that, Bethany?
That was a very succinct answer. I think, so one thing I will say, you know, just contributing, this is supposed to be both, you know, kind of livestock and human facing. Something Ellen mentioned was that placental transfer. It is very comforting to know that in the human model, I don't know if it's just due to size or placental integrity or what have you, but we do have a little more transplacental transfer of immunoglobulins in humans. So colostrum is still immensely important for our human babies, but not as necessary and not as, you know, we really hone in on colostrum management for calves because this is pretty much their only source of immunity, whereas humans have a little more robust protection.
I was going to say, it depends on the species and that type of uterus that the species has, if they have to have colostrum or not, because like puppies and cats are different than pigs or calves. And so some of the other features to add in about colostrum, when we think about this, this even goes into the human. So some of that first milk is really high both in protein, because that's that immunoglobulins coming across, but also really high in fat. So high energy, because they're not consuming a much when they're first born, so they have to get a lot of energy. So from a predatory standpoint, we all work with predatory type that are, you know, herd animals that are susceptible to predators, that they have to be able to get up and move. And so that high energy, that really nutrient dense product of colostrum on the animal side and human. So if you'll notice that change, but usually that colostrum in first milk, regardless of species, is high in fat because that animal is not going to consume that much at birth, and it needs to, Mother Nature needs to get it up and move in so it's not susceptible to predators.
That's a great point, Casey. And I think something I would add to that too, this is something we taught in my lactation class for undergrads when I was a TA. But the question then becomes like, well, why don't moms just make that milk for the calf or the human the entire time? And to your point, it's because it's so energetically demanding. And so I think this relates to if you're a dairy farmer or if you're a mom, right? Sometimes you get worried about the amount of milk that's made for that first milking or breastfeeding session. It's kind of hard to talk about both at the same time. But either way, yeah, either way, volume is a concern, but it's because it's so energetically demanding that that amount, that first milking, that first feeding is going to be low. And then gradually as, quote, your milk comes in, either if you're a cow or a human, you're going to have higher volume, lower fat, lower protein, but both serve a purpose.
Yeah, I was, as a mom, one of the biggest things, because I had, you know, I was sick and I had preeclampsia and I had to have emergency C-section. I didn't have that much volume, but it still was pretty darn potent of energy. So, and I love to call a colostrum a good colostrum and be like liquid gold in my mind, because you want it to be that yellowish tint coming out.
Yeah, and I noticed, so with both of my daughters, but especially my second, because I was just a little more observant the second time around, you get that golden calf colostrum. But honestly, human colostrum is kind of that golden color too, and I was geeking out about that. I was like, look what I just made!
Yep. That's the nutritionist in us, I think. So.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to one of my colleagues who's a dairy cow nutritionist, and she just gave birth to twins. And she was calling one of our ruminant nutrition specialists, and he asking him, what amino acids do I need to balance so that I can feed my twins the best possible way and maximize my milk production?
Oh my God. That's a question. All right. Jeez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did not go that detailed.
Well, what are some other components of colostrum besides that energy and protein that we touched on that's kind of important in discussion and we get into, especially more on the humans, should you breastfeed or, you know, formula? What are some advantages of cow's milk in colostrum as they transition off colostrum and into milk? There's a lot of different components in these sources that we don't always talk about.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the other big things, like you were saying, in colostrum that they kind of fly under the radar, but are certainly very important are things like your growth factors and your growth hormones that are in there. You know, things like lactoferrin, which all speaks to gut health, kind of just that overall health of the calf system, whether they're absorbed or whether they kind of circulate within the gut, just making sure that calf has the best possible start with all those other little goodies coming in aside from the immunoglobulins that get her off to that good start and protect her again while her own immune system starts to develop and really kick in to take over.
Yeah, honestly, I think you hit on all the main ones there. That's becoming more and more of a conversation too, some of these additional metabolic factors, immune support factors that can be found in colostrum. And why I'm sure, Ellen, you're having this conversation too on the dairy side, why we're starting to promote more and more extending the feeding of colostrum and transition milk beyond the first feeding. Because while immunoglobulins can only be absorbed in the first 12 to 24 hours because they are such a big protein, a lot of those other immune factors, growth factors, like you said, they're either circling the gut or they are being absorbed and just support so much more robustly that calf as a whole. So my kind of theory is we should probably try to get as much right with that first feeding as possible. But if we have some problems with that first feeding, we can actually save a lot. We can rescue a lot if we have a second or a third or even a fourth feeding to really support that calf longer term.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been amazing. It seems like it's been a really, really hard hit area of focus right now in the research world right now is, you know, that transition milk moving from colostrum to whole milk. And if we can mimic that on our calf raising facilities, in our calf raising facilities, something like a colostrum replacer or a colostrum supplement. And Bethany, I don't know if you have a guideline for this, but kind of the rule of thumb that I've been going off of and working with our farmers about is, you know, ideally we're getting 200 grams of IgG into that calf as soon as possible after birth. And then what I've been trying to recommend and really trying to support is that over the next, you know, 10 to 14 days, I'd like to see another 200 grams of IgG getting into those calves. Not 200 grams, you know, every single day in that 10 days, but 200 grams over that 10 to 14 days. So maybe a 10 to 15 gram dose of IgG into those calves. And it's been amazing for those farms that may be struggling with some early calfhood health issues, how it really seems to turn those animals around and is supporting them through those first critical 2 weeks.
Yep, that's exactly where my benchmarks are too.
I was going to say, for our audience, we keep abbreviating IgG, and so can we just talk about the different immunoglobulins because there's G, A, M?
So it depends on the species. Which subtype is the most important? For dairy cattle, it's immunoglobulin G. And there is IgG1 and IgG2. And we don't need to go into how those differ. But basically, IgG is by far the most important for dairy calves. There is a little work coming up on kind of the importance of IgA and IgM in dairy calves. And I guess I should clarify, too, when we talk about like those different letters at the end, those are just differences in the way that the protein is folded and responds to pathogens, I think, essentially. So that's why pretty much exclusively you'll hear in the dairy space, we talk about IgGs as kind of a proxy for our total antibodies.
And I would just touch on when we look at other species, IgG is essential in swine, but as that milk changes over, you'll have a lot more IgA, and that's because it's targeting bacteria and lining the bacteria in the guts of the neonates. And so that production, immunoglobulins happen all the time, but IgG only has that 24-hour window, usually in the species that need it to be absorbed because of the size and the tight junctions shrink back down.
For the common public who's not necessarily exposed to dairy farms, or all they see is the pictures of that cow on the green pasture or the mama cow and her calf together, what is your feedback or comments for pertaining around the question of why we take calves away from moms? We talk about how the colostrum is so important for the baby calves and that it comes from mom within the first, you know, 24 to 48 hours of that calf being born. How do we address that, properly educate those that may be misinformed?
That's a very good question, Morgan. Certainly a, a hot button question in the industry these days, certainly. But yeah, there's certainly very, very good reasons why in the dairy industry we typically do pull that calf from the cow within, you know, some do it right away, some do it within the first few hours of birth, kind of depending on when that calf is born and what's happening at the dairy. But I would say the main reasons for doing that is that, number one, like I had said before, those calves are born with little to no immune system, right? They are extremely susceptible to picking up pathogens, to picking up bacteria. And if they do, that can just wreak havoc on their system. It can cause diarrhea. It can cause navel infections. It could cause respiratory disease. So one of the main reasons we pull calves away from the cow relatively quickly is to get that calf into that clean, dry, warm environment where she's not exposed to any pathogens that could be in the maternity barn, that could be hanging onto the cow. That's one big reason. Another reason that we don't necessarily let the calves suckle the dam is that we want to see exactly how much colostrum that cow is giving. We want to see if she's giving 2 quarts of colostrum, if she's producing 4 quarts, really so we can lock in on how much that calf is getting, if she's getting adequate quantity to support her immune system and get her off to that good start. And we also like to test that colostrum for quality right at the farm level too, right at the farm gate. And that's something we can do again when we go and milk that cow, test that colostrum quality, get it to the calf. And again, just ensuring that she's off to that best possible start.
You know, and something I'll add, and maybe this is kind of an out there opinion or thought process, but I'll never forget, I was like a second year PhD student and went to a board meeting with like these very high up faculty members, and two of them got into this big discussion around that exact topic. One from that colostrum availability argument, and then one from an animal behavior and welfare perspective. And it was actually one of the first times where I saw a disagreement in the dairy space. So I do think it's important to note, just for the general public to know, that this is something that we take very seriously. And the professionals in the field, the scientists, we are continuously researching this area to make sure that we are still doing best by our animals from that colostrum standpoint, but also from a behavioral and cognitive space to get calves off to a natural and productive start.
Well, for somebody that's a, you know, animal nutritionist, maternal nutritionist for pigs primarily is my specialty, but what about the genetics of cows? Can those calves actually consume as much milk as they're producing today?
No. And that's a great point, Casey. We have bred a lactating dairy cow that makes substantially more than a calf can consume. So that, you know, is something, it's not very common, but you do see the occasional farm that does cow-calf contact for the first X number of days of life. And then you can put that cow into the lactating string, and because of that feedback of calf suckling on cow, you will see a reduction in her overall yields. But like I said, people are exploring all sorts of things. And I appreciate the dairy industry being open-minded. And I know that there's going to be a lot of differences of opinion there. But I think at the end of the day, we all have the best intentions for how we raise our calves.
Well said. I think it's perfect. I do. Honestly, even at the Dairy Cattle Welfare Council meetings, that I feel like more and more industry, nutritionists, veterinarians, and even, you know, grocery buyers are attending. That is a hot topic in our industry.
It is.
It seems like from top to bottom, regardless of where someone is within the dairy food chain, for lack of a better term, it is front of mind that these animals have the utmost welfare and are allowed to express those natural behaviors that they've hit the ground with.
Right. And I feel from a consultant standpoint, we need to be preparing our farmers for the possibility that that's going to happen, and also understand that there is research supporting both sides of this conversation.
On the swine side specifically, there's the consumer push and the, I think, just general public push for the open pen gestation and open, like the whole Prop 12 conversation really plays into the whole dairy animal welfare side of things as well.
Yeah. We even go to Europe on the sow side and they're doing free access farrowing stalls. And there's a reason why we lock the sow up is to protect the baby. And it's the same thing, you know, from a dairy perspective that we're also trying to do.
It's the delicate balance of what's best for the calf what's best from a consumer perspective and social license, and also what's best for, quite frankly, the business, you know, and all of those play a role. All those participate in the sustainability of the dairy itself.
Bethany, I know you're a mom. You have two young little girls. Did you breastfeed both your girls?
I did.
And then when it came to transitioning them to whole milk, I presume,
mm-hmm.
Through your motherhood journey, how did you balance, you know, here's what I can provide them in with breast milk. Here's possibly the benefits of formula if I needed to go that route. And then how did you choose, you know, whole milk versus, and I think I'd like you to explain to our audience a little bit more on what's the difference between whole milk, 1%, 2% skim, because I think a lot of people are like, well, what's the difference? And 2% is healthier and, you know, that conversation.
Sure. Okay. Loaded question. I want to start this out. I reflected a lot about if we go down this route. I want to share with your audience that I want everyone listening to give themselves a lot of grace for wherever they are at in a breastfeeding or feeding their child journey. Both if you are the parent that's breastfeeding or if you're supporting somebody, breastfeeding is very emotional. And it's a lot different than a cow making milk because I guess we just have that extra level of cognition to it, right? And so whatever I say about my journey, it does not mean that your journey is any lesser than mine because I did breastfeed my children or because I understand the science behind why I chose that route. So I just wanted to start with that. But so yes, Morgan, I have two young daughters. They are 4 and 2 and I breastfed both of them. My first for about 14 months and my second for about 10. I chose to breastfeed, to be quite frank with you, one, because I was interested in the science, and two, because I didn't want to have to pay for formula.
I was right there with you.
But I, you know, it was very interesting to, you know, watch the journey of, you know, the physiology of transitioning from colostrum to regular milk in my breasts and the amount that would fluctuate depending on the growth spurt of my child. So that was cool. Was it without challenge? No, right? It was very challenging to, eventually I went back to graduate school with both my children. I had them both during grad school, so I'd have to go back to work, you know, so finding the time to pump and fit all of that in, it did get very stressful. Thankfully, I was in a very supportive environment that allowed me to do that for the time that I did. The decision on when to end, again, very personal for every family. For me, it wasn't so much based on science as it was based in just the pace of my child and my lactation itself. I first was about 14 months at the peak of COVID. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to keep feeding a little while longer because of that immune support, right? You know? And then we were done around that time. She just self-weaned. And my second, I stopped a little bit early, about 10 months, quite frankly, due to change in job to the job I have now and just the inability to keep up with pumping with that. I did transition to whole milk to both at that time. Again, if you are somebody who is breastfeeding, definitely talk to your pediatrician, a nutritionist, whoever about this. That is what worked best for our family. And my pediatrician said, you know what? Your daughter's gaining really well. I'm okay with you switching at about 10 and a half months. And we chose whole milk for our family. So to your question about the different milks out there. To me, being raised on a dairy farm and obviously being a part of the dairy industry, milk was my first choice. I believe wholeheartedly in the nutritious benefits of milk. You know, a pretty similar composition of both fat and protein to human milk, at least enough so where it's kind of become the standard for human nutrition, as well as kind of the essential vitamins and minerals that can be found in milk. Was really excited about all that. Now, there are different percent fat milk options out there, as you probably are well aware, from skim up to whole. Common misconception is that whole milk is just like full fat, right? And that's not entirely true. I guess it's very far from the truth. Dairy cow's milk is anywhere between about 3 to 4% fat, and it is standardized to 3.25% fat for whole milk that we feed our kids. Then 2% is obviously 2% fat, 1%, et cetera. And I actually know what skim is. I would assume no fat. Yes, because it's skimmed. That's right. Yes, 0% fat on the skim. You can clearly tell I was not raised in a skim household.
Skim is not better because the lactose goes up and you have more sugars. And so you still have calories.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so there's actually, you know, probably people remember kind of like the Obama era administration really kind of pushing some of those lower percent fat milks from a health standpoint. But a lot of more recent research has supported kind of this full fat is 3.25% fat milk as being a little more beneficial from like a cognitive development. That fat really helps with that. I birthed big babies, so I like the additional fat to keep them growing strong. So those are my reasons. And, you know, like I said, definitely talk it over with your pediatrician. Feel free to contact, you know, a dairy farmer in your life to kind of hear that side of things. But just know that, like, no matter which product you choose, you're doing the best for your family.
Yeah, I know. I know we had, or I've had a very similar experience to you. You know, my oldest, I breastfed for 14 months, a second, just about a year. And we transitioned at, you know, 12 months to whole milk. But could you maybe, even for myself included, enlighten us on, do you know why there's like that 12 month recommended mark or that pediatrician's suggest for when to transition from breast milk to whole milk? Or I mean, now the CDC recommends 2 years of breastfeeding now.
So the CDC recommendation comes from more of the language is around more like support, like let's try to support women who choose to breastfeed up to 2 years. And I would love if somebody could reach out to me and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not 100% certain of the literature. But my understanding is there's not very good literature around duration of breastfeeding on infant success. You know, we're very lucky to even get, you know, yes or no breastfeeding study, right? Because it's such, when we study humans, there's so many variables that go into lactational success, that go into infant outcomes, that it's really difficult to pinpoint, yeah, that was because she breastfed, or yeah, that was because she breastfed for 6 months, right? So when it comes to the duration that we should be providing breast milk for, you know, some of those immune and growth benefits, there's not a lot of solid evidence to support how long. The general recommendation, you know, to try to breastfeed, you know, I've heard like, oh, if you can make it to 6 months, that's great. Or, you know, first couple months, that's good. And then that transition at 12 months to a whole milk product, I believe it has something to do with iron availability, but I could be wrong about that. Yeah, it looks like Casey's. I'm going to let Casey hop in.
Yeah, definitely iron availability and some of that. But you can also supplement for iron. So, and then depending on what the foods when you transition the child to, if they're in iron, but that is something you have to watch. And they do have different. So like Arthur, because he was a preemie, we had to give him iron supplements and he took it in his bottle and he didn't know if he liked it or not. But not all kids will take that iron supplement, and so we masked it in milk, but he needed that anyways on top of formula and breast milk mixed together.
Yeah. Is it because of the mechanism by which the proteins that are absorbed in whole milk versus the nutrients?
It has to do with lactoferrin and the receptors of lactoferrin in the gut.
Which we should define, lactoferrin is a protein found in milk that is associated with iron uptake. Is that correct?
Yes.
My understanding, too, is the oligosaccharide composition of human breast milk is quite a bit different from bovine, which is why, like, a lot of the times you'll see formulas, infant formulas that have, like, a special oligosaccharide formulas, because those molecules in particular are quite different in between our species, and that's one that's pretty important for both gut and brain development. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of the recommendation for that whole milk switch a little bit later.
Yeah, possibly. Ellen, could you maybe elaborate more on the features of milk replacers that we use for transitioning calves from colostrum to milk replacers, I guess?
Yeah, good question. I would say for the most part, if there is a dairy farm that is choosing to feed milk replacer over, say, whole milk from the cow, that transition happens usually pretty quickly. I would say most oftentimes by day two or three of life after those calves get their colostrum feedings. And it's typically a pretty smooth transition. It seems like when calves first make that change to milk replacer, they do well. And there's been more research on milk replacer than we could probably ever read in our lifetimes. Unbelievable amount of research. And the companies that produce and manufacture milk replacer hold it very, very high, very high. Extremely important. Everyone knows it on developing and getting these calves going, getting them performing, getting them growing and keeping them healthy. So all of our milk replacers, again, Bethy and I work for competitive companies, but you know, our milk replacers, I'm sure, are formulated very, very similarly in terms of having the proper vitamin profile within those milk replacers, the right trace minerals in the right form in those milk replacers. And then we also bring in typically other additives that really support gut health and the overall health of the animal, whether that's probiotics, whether it's prebiotics. There's some essential oil blends we can bring in, but those calves do transition well. And again, they get that full fortification and that full gut health support through the milk replacer, which is, again, calves do very, very well on whole milk, and they do very, very well on milk replacer as well.
Do you know the percentage that's used in whole milk versus milk replacer?
That, I think that's, it can be very regional. I would say in the areas I work in, I would say at least 80% are milk replacer, and in the upper Midwest, and maybe even higher. Bethany, I don't know if you see the same thing out in Wisconsin.
Oh, I would say I'm probably seeing about 60% replacer and 40% whole milk.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And when you say whole milk, you're saying straight from the cow to the calf.
Usually it is pasteurized in between. But yes, okay. That general concept. Yeah.
I was hoping somebody would bring up that word. What does pasteurized mean and what's the pros and cons?
We're hitting all of the controversies today.
Hey, we're educational, but it's in a positive light.
So pasteurization is named after Louis Pasteur, who is the scientist who kind of invented the process. It is basically the process in which any sort of biological substance is heated to a very high temperature to remove negative pathogens, negative bacteria primarily. It is done with any sort of milk product you would find on the shelf in a grocery store, and we do recommend it for whole milk that is fed to our dairy calves. There is controversy around the necessity to pasteurize for both human consumption and honestly on the calf side too, because there's concern that we're losing some of those bioavailable factors that are found in milk that might be kind of degraded under high temperatures. The literature, I will speak to on the calf side, the literature supports, if we are very specific about the temperature and time that we use, that we don't lose those most important goodies. Things like that IgG, the overall protein content, that will stay the same. So to me on the calf side and personally on the human side too, the risk of consuming a harmful bacteria does not outweigh the reward that you might get with getting a few of those extra micronutrients, if you will.
What's your thoughts, Ellen?
I agree 100%. Bethany said it very well, that the risk of not pasteurizing does not outweigh the reward by any means. And, you know, there are very specific temperatures in which we would pasteurize either whole milk or colostrum. With colostrum, we typically target a quote unquote low and slow. So low temperature pasteurization for a longer time. And the benchmark there is at 140 degrees for an hour. That does effective pasteurization, reducing pathogen load. And it also, like Bethany said, maintains those IgGs that are found within the colostrum. So they don't get denatured at 140 degrees, and that the calf can still absorb them and utilize them, and they're still very functional. When it comes to whole milk, we have a lot more flexibility there on how we pasteurize. We can go high temperature, short time, or we can go that same route of pasteurizing colostrum, where it's a more of a low and slow.
So is the same pasteurized milk that those calves are being fed, is that the same pasteurized whole milk that we find in the grocery store?
Not quite. Close. So this might be fun for your listeners to kind of understand the process. So a farm milks their cows into a big bulk tank, and then one or two times a day, a truck will come and pick that milk up. It's all brought to a milk processing plant where it's all combined. It's tested for things like antibiotics or water dilution. So all of the milk you are consuming is antibiotic free because it is tested multiple times. And then it is processed for human consumption. So it goes through the process of pasteurization and also homogenization. And that's just the process of making the fat globules that you find in milk equally distributed across the milk. If you ever go to a local processor of milk, sometimes they'll have non-homogenized and you can kind of see that cream at the top, which some people love and some people are like, what the heck is that? So those are kind of the two main things that will help happen at the milk processing plant for your fluid milks.
Yeah, I think that's really important to highlight because every single cow's milk profile is going to be different. And so I think for a consumer that goes to the grocery store, one of the biggest things that we want to touch and see and feel whatever we're consuming, and we want to make sure that what we're buying is the exact same thing every single time. And throughout the dairy industry, and you can even translate this into slaughter facilities or other production endpoints for livestock animals, is that when that consumer is buying a gallon of milk once a week, they want to make sure that it's the exact same thing every single time.
Mm-hmm. And safe and nutritious.
Yes.
I do have an off the topic colostrum question for both of you, because I've been doing some pet research and I'm doing some formulation for some pet clients recently. And some of these supplements are actually using bovine colostrum in dog products for calming agents and behavior. What are your thoughts and knowledge on that from a colostrum perspective?
That is a good question. I don't know if I've really seen it much on the pet food side, but I know I've seen it a whole bunch on the human TikTok side. These colostrum supplements that have taken TikTok and who knows where by storm. In my opinion, I think it's I think it's a little goofy, maybe. From the research I've seen on the efficacy of these colostrum supplements, you know, I was just reading an article, something that came through from the Journal of Dairy Science today, and it said, you know, to see any kind of benefit from a colostrum supplement, it takes 40 to 60 grams. Again, this is on humans, because I'm not really sure on the cat and dog side. 46 to 60 grams of colostrum to see these benefits, and most of the packaging is down to like 2 gram doses. So it's very interesting what's kind of caught the world by storm. And
oh, yeah.
I would and rather that colostrum going to our calves as well.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's what's done in humans, it's good for pets too. And that's the kind of the mindset. And then I look at it and I'm like, it's just on the label to be on the label. It's not at a level that it's going to do anything for the animal.
Right. Right.
I will say though, I need to find that article, Ellen. That's interesting. But I think having these human-based colostrum supplements is so awesome for the dairy industry. Like, isn't it great to be able to talk about the immense benefits of colostrum and then say, and then just a couple lactation cycles later, look, we have this other nutritious product that's a lot cheaper and available at any grocery store. You should give it a try. So I'm excited about that.
True. As long as they're not taken away from the calves, I'm all for it.
Right. Yes. And then that's a whole other thing, right, Ellen? Don't rob Peter to pay Paul.
Right. Exactly.
This is, again, kind of another hot topic. For those that do not like cow's milk or think that humans shouldn't drink cow's milk because it's not normal, I'm sure you have heard that comment before. How can you just educate our consumers on the differences between those plant-based or alternative milk sources versus cow's milk? Who wants to take that one?
Okay. All right. Well, I'll put on my lactation physiologist hat first here.
Here we go.
Milk is a substance that is derived from a mammal. Milk is secreted by an animal for animal consumption. It's fine that we call other things milk. I'm not going to be that person that gets all bent out of shape about that. But it is not the same from a nutrition standpoint in Yep. its base form, right? So when we talk about plant-based alternatives, those have had additional micro and macronutrients that have been added in to the water and blended plant substance to get it up to a similar nutrient composition as cow's milk, bovine milk. That's fine, right? It may not be quite as bioavailable. It goes through more steps of processing. It's just up to the consumer to decide if they want to consume kind of this whole undiluted beverage or one that has been more
made more processed.
Yes. Yes. I'm trying not to be too biased as I say this. One that has gone through more steps to get to where it needs to be. There are different plant-based milks that have, you know, kind of come to the surface with, you know, oh, you know, this might not be so great from like an estrogen perspective or high sugar content. I'm not going to beat any one plant-based alternative to the ground, but I think it is important to share that, you know, like what you get from your gallon of milk has not been adulterated in any way. If you look at the ingredients, it's milk and vitamin D added. That's it. You know, whereas the steps to get to a plant-based milk are a lot more extensive.
And I would say vitamin D added because milk's not always high enough in vitamin D for what humans need.
Right. And historically, because humans consumed milk in such high quantities, deficiency of vitamin D was very common back in the day. And so it's kind of like the same as iodized salt. There's iodine in salt because salt and milk, you know, are very commonly consumed items. And it's a good way to get some of those nutrients in that humans very commonly lack.
Ellen, I'm going to switch it over to you a little bit on this whole milk versus alternatives. And for the consumers that are lactose intolerant, we have actually come out with some alternatives for them. And what are some new versions of milk that help those people that do have that lactose intolerance?
Yeah, very good question. For those that are lactose intolerant, I think years and years ago, they didn't really have any options when they were wanting to consume whole milk from a cow. And now those options have certainly exploded and multiplied. I think probably one of the most popular lactose-free milks right now is Fairlife milk, which is really unbelievable what they've done in this space by, you know, pulling the lactose out, reducing the overall sugar, increasing the protein, and really extending that shelf life. You know, I was actually down in Arizona back in November, and I met with someone from Fairlife, and the research and the technology that they're putting into this is absolutely fascinating, you know, in creating these lactose-free options for the consumers. So I think it's great. There are many, many other companies out there that are producing this lactose-free milk, but I think, you know, at this point, I think those that have a lactose intolerance are certainly pretty excited about being able to safely consume dairy milk.
On a 1 cup to 1 cup comparison, nutritionally, how does the alternative milk sources compare to our whole milk? I know we kind of highlighted on the vitamin D and whatnot, but is there anything like calorie-wise, protein-wise, nutritionally that's different, or are you really getting the same amount of nutrition from a glass of alternative milk versus a regular glass of whole milk?
Ooh, you're asking me to cite some graphics out there. I would tell you to look up a reliable source on that one. But I do know that the plant-based alternatives usually do their best to try and match the fat and protein content that's found in milk, because that's kind of a main reason why we consume those products, right? There are a couple that fall short on the protein category. I won't do myself the disservice of naming them because I don't remember what they are and be a guess. And there's quite a few that fall short on the sugar category. They tend to be quite a bit higher in sugars, you know. It's just, I'm sure Casey would agree, just the same as formulating any ration, right? Like every time that you have to add in more of one macronutrient, you have to take more of another one away. So when we try to mimic something, it's never going to quite be perfect.
Yeah, and I know I've seen people try to argue that the nutrient profile of alternative milk sources is better than whole milk, and I feel there's a disconnect.
From a sustainability standpoint, we get pushed on this a lot, and when we look at almond's probably a top alternative milk source out there. And you look at the water consumption almond farmers have in California, but when we hear water usage and land usage, it's the dairy farmers of California that get, you know, hammered versus the almond production. And kind of walk through, I guess, one of you talking about the sustainability, and that's a hot topic in our industry, but the dairy industry has been an incredible sustainable partner in that and has made huge progress over time.
Yeah, and in terms of sustainability, again, that's a big time hot button topic, you know, when it comes to not only just the dairy industry, but agriculture in general, and very heavily researched area. I know one thing a lot of nutrition companies are doing is carbon credit type feed additives that you can actually feed to cows, feed to livestock, not only to increase efficiencies on the farm, but also, you know, take in those carbon credits, recordable carbon credits, and do some sustainability work through that space. There's also been some research coming out actually with our parent company, Alltech, that's showing that cattle on pasture or out on grass are actually sequestering a lot more carbon than they're pulling out or they're creating. So it's pretty amazing. Morgan, I don't know if you want to chat more on our Planet of Plenty. I of course can't remember all the details of it, but it's amazing to show that when you really dive into it, cattle certainly don't have the impact that maybe the public thinks they do. You know, when you consider industry, when you consider automobiles, when you consider oil and gas and, you know, one airplane ride across the country, you know, the dairy industry is really a drop in the bucket compared to a lot of that, those other spaces.
Yeah. And I know that we have Alltech specifically has been trying to become a leader in the sustainability story. Over the last year or two, they've been working on telling the story of ag and sustainability, and they're launching a new video. Mm-hmm. And I think it's being released on Netflix.
Yeah, very soon. I think within the next few months, I'm pretty sure. It's called A World Without Cows.
Yeah.
And basically we had a documentary crew go out around the entire world and really dive into the science and what would happen if the world didn't have cows. What would it look like? So very excited for that to come out here soon.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And I would just point out to the audience is the first world dairy industry gets hit hard for the third world dairy industry. Because you go to India, that's the largest cow population. They're not allowed to genetically select for milk traits. You know, the cows live forever with their culture and things. And that is kind of where some of that negativity, I think, from a carbon perspective comes from, is they're kind of have their hands tied as a dairy industry of how to make their cattle industry more sustainable. And plus, to get the same amount of milk, they need more cows than we do in the U.S.
Right. I think their efficiencies just aren't where they need to be, certainly.
I think a couple things I would add as somebody who, I don't know if I'd call myself a dairy farmer just yet, but my parents dairy farm and I help. But some things that I see on the day to day there, you know, that I think would be great for just our audience to understand too is, one, the dairy industry as a whole in the United States has set what we call a net zero initiative. So, you know, yes, Casey, you're right that, you know, our contributions are, I think, a lot more minimal than people realize, but we still have the responsibility as somebody who does generate carbon and one of the few industries that can actually, like you said, sequester carbon or bring it back into the ground. We have a lot of responsibility to do right by that. So, the U.S. dairy industry has set some goals for being carbon net zero by 2050. And that's something that we as dairy farmers play a role in, right? Like Ellen said, like in choosing the forages that we feed, in being cognizant about when we plant certain forages in our ground. I encourage everyone to go check out Farmers for Sustainable Food. That's an organization that works with like local watershed groups across the Midwest to determine where we should plant, when to plant like winter crops for low tillage, things like that. So farmers are getting really smart about how they manage their soil and their water and their air surroundings. I think I'll put it that way. I'm not an agronomist, clearly, but we're doing a lot there. And then the last thing I say, I just think this is so cool. We don't talk about it enough, is the amount of recycling of materials that dairy farmers do. Right? Like just a super micro example. I see those ads for like, you know, oh, use these bags to like recycle your socks and your towels and things, and we'll take care of it for you. And I'm like, I don't have to do that because I live on a dairy farm, right? I use my leftover towels to dry my baby calves. I use leftover socks to, I don't know, clean off oil on the tractor, right? Like everything on a farm is reused 20 times. And that doesn't even begin to start with a lot of the byproducts that we feed our cattle. You know, the biodiesel that's getting really popular out in California. What do you think happens to that leftover soybean meal? We feed it to our animals, right? Everything has tertiary purposes in livestock and in agriculture industries. And without that, like you said, without cattle, what would that look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you just made. And I don't think everyone or people that aren't involved in ag on the day-to-day basis, I don't think they I know they don't understand the just everything that goes into raising animals. And it's way more complicated, and there's so many inputs and outputs. And I think dairy cows specifically are a very valuable resource because we not only get milk from that animal, but after they are done providing us with milk, we also are getting meat from them as well. And
mm-hmm.
it's kind of full circle with
cow. Mm-hmm. You know, and something I would say kind of along those lines too is like, we recognize that we are a big part of a big life cycle, and we don't take that responsibility lightly, right? Every part of the resources that go in, but the resources that go out, we want them to be as efficient as possible and honestly as respectful to the animal's life as possible.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you had any additional thoughts to add.
I was going to say, I agree. And I'll show my cards here. I did not, like I said at the beginning, I did not come from a dairy background or an agricultural background at all. I'm from a city in Canada. My family was all healthcare oriented on the human side. So I could say in terms of ag, I lived under a rock, and I was a kid who, you know, grew up thinking that I was going to find fat chunks in my 2% milk or my whole milk if I drank anything other than skim or 1%. And I was someone who, you know, would look at a picture of a calf, you know, and not really understand why it wasn't with the dam for its life and everything like that. So I think me being that person many, many years ago, and now that I'm educated and understand all the whys behind why we do what we do, I think it's really important for us as members of agriculture and members of the dairy industry and across species that we really need to tell our story much, much better than we do. I think we're getting a lot better at telling the story of ag and the whys behind the decisions that we make. And that's, yeah, I think we just need to continue getting better at that story and really keeping at the forefront that the health and success and the welfare and the behavior of our animals is the success of the farm. It's the success of the nursery. It's the success of the dairymen in general. So that, of course, is always center of mind, for sure.
Amen.
I was going to say, you could almost maybe cry there a little bit, but it's awesome to meet people who are passionate, and thank you for sharing your stories.
Yes.
And that there's science and passion and love behind it. And I think Bethany really shows it, that she is truly a dairy farmer at heart, as I am a pig farmer at heart. And it is kind of, we're lucky to welcome people who aren't from our industry because you make us better. And mm-hmm. I bet, Ellen, you have changed our industry and our mindset. And I appreciate you pointing that out of us telling the story. And that's exactly what we did today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's our goal. And that's why Casey and I are doing what we're doing with this podcast and educating the consumer and trying to shed light on why we do what we do within the agricultural world. And just, you know, I saw Marissa Hake, calf vet, said something online the other day about how we're a herd. We work with pack animals, and we need to work on building our herd, not necessarily our animal herd, but our community and our herd of individuals that, yes, our tribe, and how
beat the drum. Let's do it.
And I really resonated with that. And
it's true. It's so true. Of course, Marissa hitting it nail on the head again.
As always.
As always.
We're hopefully hoping to have her someday. Yes.
So if she's listening, we want you to come on too.
So Bethany, Ellen, we like to leave our audience with an action item, whether that's just thought-provoking comment or some sort of action that they can do within their lives to educate themselves or better themselves just in general. Do either of you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I guess maybe this sounds silly, but maybe it doesn't. I think my action item is to, you know, if you've never been to a dairy farm, I encourage everyone out there to go and visit one. Just to see it. Dairymen are unbelievably welcoming. They like showing off their animals, their facilities, what they do for a living. You know, if it's connecting a school group with going out to a farm or whatever the case may be, I fully encourage you to get out there and just see, because once upon a time, that's what I did. And now look at me, 10 years in and loving every second of it.
And they're just big dogs. Just go give them a hug.
That's right.
They love the scratches too.
They do.
And I'm going to take the other arm of this conversation and give an action item about the human side of lactation. We talked about the importance of colostrum and some of the benefits of breastfeeding. So my action item for our listeners is to think about, if you work for a company or if you go to a library frequently, think about kind of your community and how is it set up to support breastfeeding parents.
Amen.
Do you have resources so that people who are breastfeeding can continue to breastfeed with as little stress as possible?
I'm sure you've experienced trade shows where there's...
Yeah, I have pumps in more than one bathroom.
So have I. Or I'm always that person like who emails the trade show coordinators like 2 weeks before the show. Hey, is there any room available for mothers? And then I'm the one that's making them scramble to find a place.
And that's why I bring up this action item, right? Like, let's be proactive in thinking about our events and understanding to be inclusive to all people. We need to think about the needs that working mothers might have.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Raise the roof.
I think this was a great conversation and there was a lot of value.
Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. This was fun.
But yeah, we really appreciate you guys and thank you very much for taking the time out of your guys' day to help in our cause and our purpose of trying to educate.
Absolutely.
Have fun in Denver, Ellen, too.
Thank you. Yeah. I will. It was nice to meet you, Casey. You too, Bethany. And I'll come find you at the next conference. I'll come bug you.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, you guys.
All right. Bye. Take care. Bye.